In part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois.
What's on your mind? Share your thoughts on our new program, The Public Square, beginning Friday, October 1st. Each week, we'll air the comments of a member of our community at 4:45 and 6:45 on Fridays, and again Saturday mornings just before 11. Call us at 244-5074 or log on to WILL.UIUC.edu to find out more about The Public Square, coming to your public radio station, WILL, Urbana.
This is AM 580 WILLL Urbana. My name is Jack Brighton, hosting Focus 580. Glad you could listen. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. I'm sure we all remember where we were and how we felt on September 11, 2001. An event like 9/11 will motivate a strong reaction, and as citizens of a nation that was attacked, we would hope for a strong response by our government. The immediate statement from our president was to say, "This means war." But the war on terrorism is of a different nature than any previous war, and in this election year, it seems we are just beginning to debate the ways in which the Bush administration has conducted the war on terrorism. During this hour, Focus 580 will look closely at the response by the United States since 9/11 and consider other actions we might take to address the terrorist threat and to increase the security of America and the world. Our guest is John Gershman, co-director of the Global Affairs Program at the Inter-Hemispheric Resource Center and principal author of a new report published by the Foreign Policy in Focus Task Force on Terrorism. The report is entitled A Secure America in a Secure World. The report declares that the Bush administration's war on terrorism reflects a major failure of leadership and makes America more vulnerable rather than more secure. And it makes a number of recommendations for an alternative approach to dealing with terrorism and security. We'll talk with John Gershman about that during this hour. As we do, we invite you into the conversation. Your contributions to this dialogue are very important. We hope you will call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest, if you're listening on the air, anywhere in the continental U.S. if you're listening online, toll-free 800-222-9455. And John Gershman joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Jack. How you doing?
Doing fine. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
To begin, could you tell us, just to start a little bit, about the Inter-Hemispheric Resource Center and the work of the Foreign Policy in Focus Task Force on Terrorism?
Sure. The Inter-Hemispheric Resource Center, which is a ridiculously long name, so I'll refer to it as the IRC,
okay,
is 25 years old this year. Originally began as a nonprofit think tank focused on U.S. Latin American relations, and in the mid-1990s, jointly created a project called Foreign Policy in Focus with the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Policy Studies, the idea being that in the aftermath of the Cold War, progressives did not have a think tank that tried to articulate and debate issues of U.S. foreign policy and international affairs in contrast to other parts of the political spectrum in the U.S. And so since 1996, we have worked as a very small overhead network of several hundred analysts in the U.S. and abroad that write and do analysis on U.S. foreign policy and international affairs. We occasionally convene task forces on issues that we think are of particular import and consciously try to draw in people that would not necessarily be immediately seen as progressives in trying to articulate a broader policy agenda on a particular issue that we think is still true to our progressive values, but we try to reach out to more, let's call them, more mainstream policy figures. And so this is the second major report of this kind that we did this year. Earlier in the year, we did an alternative military budget, and task force released a report on that. And this, the report that you mentioned, A Secure America and a Secure World, had about 24 members, and what we tried to lay out was our analysis and critique of the Bush administration's approach to fighting the so-called global war on terror, and then articulate an alternative policy agenda.
Okay, and I certainly want to dive in and talk about the substance of the report, but I'm just curious about the process of doing this, because it seems that, you know, I don't know, maybe it just seems as a journalist who's been, you know, covering this for a long time, that the range of debate has been fairly narrow, and that there has been little latitude to sort of question the approach that we have taken as the United States has pursued the war on terrorism. And I think there is a natural tendency to, you know, to unify and line up behind the president. And I just, you know, think that during an election year, I would hope that we could have a real dialogue on these issues, and I wonder if you have encountered resistance to that dialogue.
I would say that we have encountered more resistance to that dialogue among people in mainstream media outlets and some people who are in the kind of the foreign policy establishment. But we find that if we're talking about regular average American citizens, if we talk about a large number of congressional staff members, and we even talk about significant numbers of both retired and current uniformed military officers, we find that there's quite an open, quite much different degree of openness and willingness to talk about these issues, in part because people feel that, you know, they're very critical and important to talk about, and in part because there's a seems to be a nagging sense that things are not going well, and this sense has been exacerbated by what's happened in Iraq. And so, but certainly within the, let's call it the gatekeepers of official debate and opinion, there's not been that much willingness to kind of broaden the debate beyond, you know, some relatively minor differences. But when we're talking about a broader public debate, certainly with American citizens, and in particular uniformed military officers, we find much more a willingness to debate. They may not agree with everything we say, but we've certainly found a willingness to engage with the issues that we have. We have a number of former Pentagon officials on the task force, one of whom served in the Reagan administration, one in the Clinton administration, and we have a retired Army intelligence officer who also served on the task force. So I think we benefited both from their insights, but I think it's also a reflection of among people who are trying to grapple seriously with the issues of security in the 21st century, they're willing to engage in a broader range of debate than let's say, what we might see on the evening news.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. Well, let's talk about the report. The report, A Secure America in a Secure World, says the Bush administration has failed in its approach to dealing with security and terrorism, and you list six factors that sort of detail this. Let's talk about each one. First, you say there has been an overemphasis on military responses.
Right. I mean, first of all, that's in the very frame of saying that we need to combat terrorism by engaging in war. And a war on terrorism, you know, if you think about fighting a war in general in foreign policy, you think about the military. And if we look at where the largest chunk of resources has gone in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, overwhelming percentage of that has gone to the military. Even though much of that spending has not necessarily been for the kind of military operations that would be of use against terrorists, it's been a much just a broader increase in the Pentagon budget. And secondly, we saw, and I think this is the clearest example of the framing the invasion and occupation of Iraq as a war on terrorism, when in fact that the connections between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda were minimal at best and certainly not operational, and that if anything, by engaging in the invasion and occupation in the way that we have actually created a new recruiting tool for al-Qaeda. So while we can see that the intervention in Afghanistan was probably appropriate, although we can perhaps disagree with exactly how it was conducted, we would view that the military needs to be in a subordinate role, and by framing things as a war, that immediately kind of gets people to focus on, you know, expanding military options, increasing military budgets, and that may not be the most effective approach.
Okay. We actually, I have several questions to follow up on that, but I will defer to callers. We do have a listener joining us on line number one in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. I have always voted a split ticket. I've never been a, true Democrat. But I am appalled at what is going on in Iraq. We certainly had our hands full with Afghanistan. And I can't believe that there are people, Republicans, who are voting for George Bush when we have this horrible situation on our hands. So I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call. Whatever you would like to say in response.
Sure. Well, I think the caller pointed to a very central issue, which was, I think there was a general recognition that something had to be done about Afghanistan, and that, there was the military operation in Afghanistan. But then very quickly, the Bush administration's attention turned to Iraq, and now we see the price of this is that you have inadequate resources, financial and military resources, devoted to reconstruction and security in Afghanistan. You still have the Taliban and al-Qaeda remnants operating in both Afghanistan and northwestern Pakistan that make the consolidation of a democratic regime very difficult. And so without having actually completed the operation there, basically ousting the Taliban and capturing and killing a number of al-Qaeda leaders, the Bush administration kind of moved on, and I think that was a big strategic error. And then, of course, deciding to focus into Iraq and the UK-based Institute for International Strategic Studies, for example, is the rough equivalent of the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States. And in their annual report on the world strategic situation, they highlighted that Iraq, the main impact that the Iraq war has had on the war on terrorism has been to lead to accelerating recruitment by al-Qaeda, because it appeared that the United States was, in fact, or could be represented, that the United States was, in fact, engaging in a war on Islam. And the failure to find WMD and so forth is basically able to reinforce a powerful recruiting story that al-Qaeda can use. And having failed to really do anything substantive in Afghanistan in terms of supporting reconstruction and security, I think this is where we find ourselves in a situation where particularly the policy in Iraq has made us worse off than would have been otherwise.
We have several callers waiting, and I promise I'll get it right to them, but I can't resist following up on this issue, because I think it's something that Americans feel very conflicted about. Mm-hmm. An example would be for when Howard Dean initially said that the war in Iraq has made America less secure. Mm-hmm. And that was greeted with a firestorm of criticism against Howard Dean for daring to say such a thing. Mm-hmm. But the problem, I think, that we have is all the things that you say may be true about how it's increased, fertilization of recruitment of terrorism and distracted us from other fronts, i.e. Afghanistan and al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. But is there any objective measure that you can use to say we are more or less secure because of the invasion of Iraq?
Well, I think we...
How do we determine if we're actually making progress in the war?
Right.
I mean, there is no... I mean, is there an objective measure?
Right. Well, I think... I don't think there is a single objective measure.
Yeah.
But I think we can look at a range of measures and look at what they might tell us about what's happened. So one thing might be, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, there was clear international support for the fact that the United States had been attacked. And we saw that in public opinion polls and so on and so forth. Since 9/11, and particularly since the invasion and occupation of Iraq, popular support internationally for the United States and anti-American sentiment has declined, and anti-American sentiment has increased, particularly in countries that are of concern in the context of having to combat al-Qaeda. So Muslim-majority countries like Indonesia, much of North Africa, the Middle East, and so forth. And these are dramatic turnarounds in terms of popular opinion and support. Polls from the Pew Charitable Trust, as well as Gallup and others, chart this just dramatic decline in popular support, and in some places, you know, in terms of ranking, who are the political figures that you trust, you know, that George Bush falls below Osama bin Laden. This is a sign that we've lost a broad wellspring of popular support that's important in terms of sustaining and maintaining the kind of international cooperation that's necessary in terms of combating terrorism. So that would be my one main indicator. The second indicator is work from places like the International Institute of Strategic Studies, which tries to chart what are the operations and membership of Al-Qaeda. And while on the other hand, we have been successful at preventing or we have not suffered an attack on the U.S. homeland since 9/11, that we clearly see a shift in Al-Qaeda's and Al-Qaeda-linked groups' operations to targeting softer targets that have lower levels of security, and that it's becoming, Americans are finding it less interesting to travel abroad because of concerns about security and so forth. And so just taking two quick kind of indicators, the level of popular support and basically the declining space where Americans can feel free and safe in terms of traveling abroad, in addition to recruiting numbers and so forth that other groups have calculated, that we see that this, I would argue that this is a real problem, and that those would be kind of primary indicators of, specifically in the case of Iraq, of because it's really attributable to Iraq. The public opinion polls did not decline as dramatically with respect to the invasion of Afghanistan. There was actually UN Security Council support and blessing to the military operation in Afghanistan, and we really see this decline only in the aftermath of the Iraq War.
Our lines are full, and I'll go on and take the next call from listeners. Let me just reintroduce our guest this morning. We're talking with John Gershman. He's the principal author of a report, A Secure America in a Secure World. It's a report from the Foreign Policy and Focus Task Force on Terrorism. It is highly critical of the approach the U.S. has taken in the war on terrorism, as the term is used. And we welcome calls. We have lines full, so I'll give up the phone numbers in a couple of minutes when we have some open. We'll go next to a listener in Chicago on line number 4. Good morning.
Hello. I think if you're truly going to take an alternative view, you need to first look at Afghanistan, because after 3 years, we do not have Osama bin Laden or any of the top people supposedly involved in the planning of 9/11. And if you think about that and think of the destruction of human life, of more than 4,000 Afghani lives, and the physical destruction of that country, which we don't even contemplate, mm-hmm. and you think, where would we have been if we had continued to negotiate with the Taliban for Osama bin Laden? I think that within 3 years, we probably would have had a negotiated solution without this terrible loss of life and physical destruction. So the military solution has been a failed one from the start, and I think that you really need to stop glossing over Afghanistan, saying, well, that one was okay. That one wasn't okay, and it was very failed. We don't have what we supposedly bombed and destroyed Afghanistan for, and Afghanistan is much worse off than it was. I don't think anyone can say that that country is better off. So I think a true alternative viewpoint starts with not glossing over Afghanistan, but talking about the failed policy there.
Well, I certainly didn't mean to gloss over Afghanistan, and I think there's some areas where we agree and some points on which we disagree. First of all, I think we can have thought experiments about, would the Taliban have turned over Osama bin Laden in 3 years? And I think that's a hard one. I remain to be convinced of that.
Well, you know that before the negotiations broke apart, they were arguing to turn Osama bin Laden off to a third party, which the United States did not agree to.
Right.
And that, I think, within 3 years, if that was your starting point at the beginning of the 3 years, I think we could have gotten somewhere.
As I said, it's entirely possible that would have been the case. I still remain to be convinced. It's not clear to me in several reasons. One is that in many ways it was Al-Qaeda that was providing the critical infrastructure for Taliban rule in Afghanistan rather than the reverse. And while certainly the Taliban was taking that rhetorical position, I think they took that rhetorical position precisely because They knew that the United States was not going to accept that. And they were, one of their conditions was also that he would be turned over to a third party and tried in a an Islamic court. And I don't know any country in the world that would allow for people who have been accused of crimes against their citizens to say, yes, you can be tried in a different kind of court. So I think the Taliban were trying to prevent and were being very strategic. But I also think they took that position because they knew it was a non-starter on the part of the U.S.
I think only if you're terribly impatient. I mean, if we were truly involved in negotiation and willing to negotiate, I simply feel that in each case there is not a sincere commitment to negotiation and always using a military solution. And the military solution has failed again and again, and we continue to ignore the fact that it's failing because we're not counting the human life. We're not counting the physical destruction of our environment. And I think that probably if one of the things I suggest your group does is sincerely look at the cost to each country with the loss of human life, the future cost, the cost to further development, the cost to the world when we have such severe environmental destruction, especially of mountain chains as we've had in Afghanistan, and then see if that military solution has been such a success.
Oh, well, we have no disagreement with you that it's not entirely clear that a military option needed to be taken in, either it needed to be taken or it needed to be taken in the way that it was. I think we would definitely agree on that, and much of our other work has to do with the costs of war, both human, ecological, financial, and that we would agree with that. My only point was to contrast, and I would disagree with you on this question of, is Afghanistan better off now than it was under the Taliban? And I think there is some plausible evidence for at least for large chunks of the country. In fact, it is better off currently than under the Taliban, but there are significantly large chunks of the country for which that's definitely not the case. But I think that for the situation of at least girls that do have access to go to school, of the fact that you're having you're going to have direct elections and that women represent 40% of the registered voters, I think there are some halting progressive steps forward and absolutely uneven, inadequate, and so forth. But I think a situation that's dramatically different than one that existed under the Taliban.
Okay. Well, we have several calls waiting. We'll go next to someone in Indiana on line number one. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
I may have taken away one question. A few weeks ago, a person who was in Afghanistan as a reporter said on one of the newscasts that basically Afghanistan, large parts of it now have been retaken by the Taliban, you know, / Al-Qaeda, and that the only really safe places are the larger cities where the United States has some forces, mm-hmm. and in the Afghanis have their forces there too. But it's still not particularly real safe to go up and down the streets certain times, you know. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask about that. And the second question, on the world scene, I'd be concerned if I was an intelligent agency to give too much information to the United States in some ways, especially after what they did to that woman who was a CIA operative, that these boys play very, very nasty game. And I often wonder if that would be a mindset for somebody, especially now that we've, you know, mainly ostracized practically everybody except a few European countries that need our money pretty bad. I just wonder if you had any comment about that, if that makes any sense whatsoever in terms of the world play.
Sure. Well, to take the Afghanistan point first, I think that's exactly the situation, particularly in South and Eastern Afghanistan. Large chunks of former Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces are operating. You also have the problem that there were people who had been part of the Northern Alliance and fought against the Taliban, and but were basically warlords and were not particularly progressive folks themselves. That you also have similar kind of sets of issues with, and that basically the current transitional government in Afghanistan is largely a Kabul and a few other kind of major regional cities, and that's in part the problem. And my original point was that that Iraq became a distraction from that. And once you had to redirect resources away from Afghanistan because you were concerned about invading and occupying Iraq, immediately reduces the availability of those resources to actually be effective in Afghanistan. It's actually NATO that is providing the troops for the security of the transitional government, and then U.S. troops in Afghanistan are supposed to be going after al-Qaeda and Taliban remnants. And again, this is one of the big costs that if Iraq becomes a kind of failed example of an alternative approach, that's going to be yet another prime recruiting tool, in addition to the fact that just you have a significant chunk of al-Qaeda folks able to operate and recruit and so forth as a result of the ongoing war. In the case of this question of broader international cooperation, and particularly in the intelligence realm, I think it's uneven there. The United States has itself not been as forthcoming as it might be in cooperating with some countries, although with others it has been good. I think the greater concern at this point is that many countries have to look askance at U.S. intelligence claims, that if you look at, for example, both Australia and the United Kingdom have done kind of fairly comprehensive reviews of their intelligence operations in the aftermath of the Iraq War, and many of them took what was being presented at face value by what was presented as the consensus view of the U.S. Intelligence Service without the U.S. intelligence community, without the various qualifications that and concerns that some members in the CIA and the State Department had about intelligence of weapons of mass destruction and so forth. But I think the major cost has been the declining reliability and reputation of U.S. intelligence, certainly has to be some concern about how intelligence provided by other countries could potentially be used or manipulated to advance a political agenda, as I think many people widely believe was done in the case of Iraq. And that would really have to, make potential partners, intelligence partners in other countries, take many second, third, fourth thinking before they engaged in cooperation with the United States, concerned both about political manipulation and secondly about how whether or not they're going to be able to count on reliable information coming back from the United States.
Well, there's more in the report, in fact, about intelligence reform and the idea being that we still haven't conducted effective reform of our own intelligence services and sort of coordinated the information that we have on, for example, a terrorist watch list.
Right. We have some things that you would think would be at least 3 years after 9/11 would be kind of no-brainers to have assembled, such as a unified terrorist watch list, and which we still don't have. And I think one of the unfortunate things is that there was momentum for intelligence reform was really delayed by the Bush administration's initial opposition to the creation of the 9/11 Commission and then dragging its feet and cooperating with it, so that the report came out much later than had originally been planned, and that kind of lost the momentum that might have existed having a report come out closer to the original attacks in a real sense that this needed to be done. And at this point, we'll see probably some relatively minor changes in the intelligence community at this point before the election. A lot depends on the outcome of the election. We've plenty of other things to do in terms of making intelligence agencies collaborate more, share information, and a lot of work to be done still in that area.
We have a couple of the callers. Let me just reintroduce our guests. We're a little past our midpoint during this hour, Focus 580 with John Gershman. He's co-director of the Interhemispheric Resource Center. You're right, that is a long title. And he's a principal author of A Secure America in a Secure World, a report of the Foreign Policy in Focus Task Force on Terrorism. And we have a couple callers waiting and a couple lines open. If you'd like to join us, 333-9455, that's around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Champagne listener next on line number two. Good morning.
Hi there. Thanks for the show. This is really interesting. First off, I just wanted to reiterate what the Chicago caller said a couple calls ago, especially about this administration's total lack of regard for human life in other countries. And that's what, you know, they claim to be such a pro-life administration. They clearly have blatant disregard for other people's lives in other countries. So I just think that's a sham. But anyway, I guess the question that I was hoping maybe you could maybe talk about a little bit is I saw Fahrenheit 911, and there was a couple questions that I don't think has been answered. One is they brought up in that movie, and I think other places, about how the link with Saudi Arabia and how several of the terrorists from 911 were from Saudi Arabia. And that country, to me, it seems like it's been kind of glossed over, like, you know, that's not really part of the problem. I don't know. But that, and also just it, the movie talked about some different family ties with the Bushes and the Bin Ladens. And so I was just hoping maybe that you could comment on that, and then I'll hang up and listen. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Sure. Well, I think the issue of Saudi Arabia, of course, needs to be central, not just with 9/11, but with broader debates about energy policy and so forth, and that in the context of 9/11, that 15 of the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. What does this mean? Well, our report looks at Saudi Arabia in kind of two dimensions. One is that Osama bin Laden and his network that he helps to find Al-Qaeda emerges in part as a direct response to the repressive nature of politics in Saudi Arabia, the other Gulf states, and the lack of openness for people to critique the policies of those regimes. And so we argue that the United States needs to really reevaluate its approach to supporting regimes that are repressive, since repressive politics can be effective breeding grounds for terrorism in the absence of other channels to articulate dissent. And so that's one dimension, certainly on energy policy. And then the third dimension has to do with the fact that Saudi Arabia is an active promoter of Wahhabism, which is a particular fairly conservative and reactionary current within Islam. And it supports very reactionary networks of madrasas, of religious schools, throughout the Arab and Islam, broader Islamic worlds that can become, again, recruiting grounds and are certainly part of an ideological current that is broadly supportive of the kind of views articulated by Al-Qaeda. And Saudi Arabia has also provided money to Palestinian organizations that engage in terrorism and so forth. So we agree that we need to really, really evaluate the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia. In the context of Mike Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, I think what's unfortunate about that movie is that it's, and yes, there were personal ties, longstanding personal ties, particularly between the Bush, the father, and the Carlyle Group, and Saudi Arabia, and the network of alliances that has emerged in since World War II, basically, that kind of tie a chunk of the U.S. elite to the Saudi Arabian elite and organized around oil and so forth in particular. But the dimension about U.S. policy towards the Middle East in general that Michael Moore leaves out has to do with U.S. policy towards Israel. And that if you look at the people, for example, who were staunchest behind the war in Iraq, these were not the people who were the closest supporters of Saudi Arabia and so forth, but people who saw, particularly Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith and others, who have for a long time seen taking out Saddam Hussein as something that would be not only in the U.S. interest, but would be in the interest of Israel. And I think Michael Moore's movie kind of glosses over this in terms of the, it's a too kind of easy to see kind of a Saudi Arabian interest-linked cabal driving things, but that there are other interests that have shaped U.S. Policy in the Middle East, including people who see the U.S.-Israeli alliance as central, and that these currents sometimes agree and sometimes disagree on appropriate policy and strategy, and that it was not really the proponents of stronger ties with Saudi Arabia or protect Saudi Arabia in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks that were really behind, for example, the invasion of Iraq. And so I think that we need to be cautious about the conspiratorial dimensions of Michael Moore's movie, even if much of the broader points that he makes are absolutely accurate and need to be raised.
Okay. Hope that gives the caller's question. We have three people waiting. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign County on line number three. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. I was going to go down to the bottom of your list and get you to talk about root causes, particularly in context of Bush's speech at the UN, but mm-hmm. I guess I have to weigh in on Afghanistan. And as far as a documentary that hits spot on, as they say over in Britain, about the cabal, I would recommend Hijacking Catastrophe from the Media Education Foundation, and that's available at both of the Champaign and Urbana libraries in a DVD form. But since we're applauding the voting effort in Afghanistan, I'd like to point out that it was applauded and applauded, and the turnout was gratifying, et cetera, et cetera. It turned out that and maybe the census is wrong, but actually there seem to be more people registered than there are in Afghanistan. And it seems to me with the place awash of warlords and drug money, raw opium and heroin trafficking is back in place, that warlords probably have a buy the electoral vote strategy, and that's probably what's going to happen, and that's the turf it's going to be fought at. I'm not trying to be reduce Afghanistan to people who are willing to sell their votes, but I mean the poverty is ubiquitous and there's also a lot of other kind of pressures for them.
I think we take your point. And, okay. And I'd also like to you know, maybe have you return to the question about attacking root causes, because that's
an
issue.
Let's go with that. Root causes is the last part in your bullet point, and I think it's an important one, and you haven't discussed it yet. So the context that I'd like to raise with W's speech is that he points at this Millennium Challenge money, which, as far as I know, and I think now covered it on PBS a couple of weeks ago, that as far as what they've done so far is they've outfitted a fancy-looking office in D.C., which you probably have visited, I guess, maybe, and haven't done any kind of development work anywhere in the world. And the AIDS money that he pointed at, $15 billion initiative, rings hollow since that's not been dispersed. Some of it's reprogrammed money, and actually he's not putting any pressure to get even the $15 million that's on the docket in the Senate for AIDS right now. So as far as poverty alleviation or reduction or elimination and a fairer economic system broadly in the world, there seems to be no particular effort in this administration at all, and I'm not confident about the next one, whichever one it is, either. So could you just talk about root causes, and I assume the lines are still jammed, so I'll just bow out and listen to the radio. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, thanks. Great question. Yes, we do talk about root causes and in the report, and one of the things that we want to do is actually argue against what's sometimes a common notion across the political spectrum that, you know, poverty is a root cause of terrorism, and in terms of the people who commit most terrorist acts, in fact, are not from the poorest groups in society. What we basically argue is that poverty and inequality in particular are important because they can be used as recruiting tools in support of the commission of terrorist acts, but it's not by and large the poor who are involved in committing terrorism. And we think that there is there's a danger in trying to say, well, we should be fighting poverty because, you know, poverty breeds terrorism. And we think we should be fighting poverty because fighting poverty should be a moral and ethical obligation. And we do happen to think it may have some relationship to terrorism, but it's not the direct one, that poverty and inequality cause terrorism, but that they can become important recruiting tools and support environments for terrorism. So we are critical of the Bush administration's, not only before we even talk about foreign aid, of its efforts to kind of say, and the way we're going to solve poverty is by having free trade agreements everywhere, and plenty of, I think, now kind of well-known criticism of the ambiguous impact or ambivalent impact on reducing poverty and inequality of untrammeled free trade and investment agreements. The Millennium Challenge account that you mentioned does involve some additional resources that the Bush administration has appropriated. As you mentioned, they've yet to be actually dispersed. And the Millennium Challenge account will actually primarily target countries that meet certain criteria for so-called good governance, which would exclude places like Afghanistan and any other number of countries that we might think of as being in need of foreign aid and assistance. So that would be one problem. The Millennium Challenge account will not deal with countries that are basically the poorest of the poor, and so not be addressing poverty in that dimension. And then the AIDS money, as you noticed, has also not been dispersed. There's also problems with tying AIDS funding to abstinence-only prevention programs. So lots of problems also with the AIDS money as well. In terms of broader issues around root causes, so we would say you need to keep an eye on states that were like Afghanistan before, the so-called failed states, because those can be important operating environments for transnational terrorist networks, either in terms of distributing finance or actual operations. And the Bush administration has no plan for dealing with states such as Afghanistan. And so we would argue that you need to have actually a plan, an approach. It should be primarily multilateral in character, and that it would have to combine both providing for security and as well as meeting the significant socioeconomic needs in any of those countries. We would see the root cause question as in part linked to politics. Is there the political space for people to engage in nonviolent forms of political dissent, and that the United States should not run around imposing our vision of liberal democracy at the point of a bayonet, but it should not at least be providing resources to regimes that systematically violate the human rights of their citizens. And so that means, you know, trying not to prop up authoritarian regimes. Unfortunately, in fighting the so-called global war on terror, the Bush administration has repeated many of the errors of U.S. policy during the Cold War, which is to back people who claim to be on your side basically overlook human rights violations. And this has been particularly the case in Central Asia and also in Pakistan. And that provides a very serious challenge to U.S. policy that we think needs to change. The role of the educational system, particularly madrasas, having stepped into, because the schooling at madrasas is free, replacing non-functioning or dysfunctional secular or pluralist and more tolerant forms of religious education, would suggest that the United States foreign aid should be focused on strengthening those types of educational institutions so that people would not be attracted to going to madrasas that preach a particular extremist form of jihadist ideology. Again, we've seen no significant initiatives on that front. And then finally, the ideological battle. You know, Al-Qaeda, we could eliminate poverty tomorrow and eliminate lots of other things, and there would still be people who would disagree with the United States and have an ideological opposition. And so in that way, the United States needs to engage that battle, but not by hiring people to do a very fancy, expensive public relations campaign on how great the United States is, but we need to look at our policies, and it's what we do, I think, and the policies that we have. And this is where support for the Israeli occupation and for the Likud Sharon government's agenda in Israel is clearly not something that speaks to being able to present the United States as supportive of international law and human rights for everyone. And so a more consistent application of policies in ways that are respectful of human rights and the human life of people elsewhere would provide a clearer statement in practice of U.S. values. I don't see that happening anytime in the near future in either the first or potentially second Bush administrations. And so that's where I think that, you know, that dimension of the battle would have to be also fought. None of these things are primarily military in nature. They involve lots of other people with different skills that don't have anything necessarily to do with firing a gun. And I think it's again, the question of Iraq highlights that the inavailability of resources to do many of these other things is very directly tied to the continued drain of resources to go into an occupation in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple calls, and I promise I'll get right to them, but just a quick follow-up. You mentioned Israel in particular being a focal point of fueling anti-American extremism. And I think it's important to note that it's an important idea maybe for people to consider, as your report does, that the United States should continue its strategic and moral commitment to Israel's sovereignty, but there is a distinction between Israel's right to exist and support for the occupation in the West Bank and Gaza.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We don't, as a task force and for myself personally, that we do recognize Israel's right to exist. We don't need a Bush administration roadmap to peace. There have been several roadmaps based on international law that would involve ending the occupation and the creation and recognition of a Palestinian state. And the unfortunate thing is the range of debate on these issues in Israel is way ahead of where that debate is in the United States, where anyone who questions Israeli policy is immediately denounced as an anti-Semite or a self-hating Jew or whatever. But within Israel, the range of debate over what should appropriate policy be and calls for ending the occupation are gain much more prominence on, op-ed pages and in the mass media, and represent significant political forces, including in the Israeli parliament, than are typically articulated in the United States. And we think it's apparently clear, at least for my, speaking for myself, that caring about Israel would dictate needing to end the occupation and in the West Bank and Gaza, because the occupation is not actually at this point enhancing Israel's long-term political security.
A couple callers remaining. We'll go next to a listener, I believe, in Kankakee on line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, Jack Brighton and guest John Gerstmann. Let us consider perhaps some very simply stated questions. It would seem as though we need to decide whether the bombings of 9/11, 2001, were actually crimes or acts of war against the United States. And secondly, if these bombings were indeed acts of war, what state or states committed acts of war, and what in fact would be the appropriate response of the United States to an act of war against the United States? Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Well,
sure. I would say they were crimes. They were crimes, large-scale mega crimes, and they were not the act of war by any state. They were crimes that were committed by a network of people, most of whom were, or all of whom were tied to the network of al-Qaeda, and that in that case you had a de facto regime in Afghanistan that was providing shelter to effectively a criminal conspiracy that had engaged in not only attacks there, but also in Tanzania and elsewhere. And so in that case, the appropriate approach, a framework to thinking about that, was that these people were criminals who would be brought to justice, and that, as sometimes happens, however, that you're not able to use legal means. That I do, all of the points made by previous callers taken into account, that there may be times when you need to use military force against those kinds of groups, but that in a minimum the basic framework is that this was a crime.
There's a quick follow-up on that. A part of your report deals with, in fact, international institutions, and the idea being that if indeed one wants international law applied in a case such as this, one would think about strengthening the International Criminal Court and the other institutions of international law,
right,
that would be capable of dealing with these things on an international cooperative basis.
Right. And I think this was, again, this is something that has contributed to a kind of broadening of anti-American sentiment worldwide, is the Bush administration's cavalier dismissal of, broadly speaking, the frameworks of international law, as well as particular institutions like the International Criminal Court, that they would represent powerful institutions to be able to strengthen the international frameworks to be able to go after terrorists, to go after terrorist finance. In the aftermath of 9/11, there has been the strengthening of a number of international conventions, and the UN Security Council has strengthened their efforts in terms of getting member countries of the United Nations to strengthen laws against money laundering and terrorist finance and so forth. But I think things would be in even better shape if you had a U.S. administration that actually saw its security, the security of the United States, as consonant with strengthening international frameworks of international law, as opposed to saying, well, there's really going to be two laws, one for us and one for everybody else. And that, again, feeds into this broader sense that the Bush administration has an agenda for empire, and that that's not going to be popularly supported throughout the world. And that's in sharp distinction from, say, the position of the United States after World War II, when we were, although not as powerful relative in relative terms than today, we're a powerful country and, you know, try to create and strengthen institutions of multilateral cooperation. And that's, I think when history looks back, the post 9/11 period is going to be seen as a tragically missed opportunity for the United States to have really brought greater attention to international law, human rights law, and really strengthen those institutions.
I'm sorry to say we have just about a minute and a half left, and there's a caller that I apologize we won't be able to include. It was not intentional. We just ran out of time. I do want to ask you, and perhaps this isn't fair to you, John Gershman, either, but we've been talking about the Bush administration's policy. Do you have any take on what the John Kerry administration might do to address the issues that you raise?
Yes. Well, I think Kerry would certainly be better in terms of, we didn't talk about it much today, domestic civil liberties issues, and certainly stronger in areas of international cooperation and so forth. I think Kerry's stance vis-a-vis Israel at this point seems to be basically the same as the Bush administration, so I wouldn't see a lot of particular progress in that direction. I do think that there would be some, to the extent that the occupation in Iraq is reduced either through withdrawal of U.S. troops or multilateralization or some process of freeing up resources for homeland security issues, for foreign aid that actually is dealing with failed states and poverty. But we would see this agenda as still being fairly much to the left of an incoming Kerry administration, and would see ourselves as having a lot to do no matter who wins on November 2nd.
Okay. Well, we'll have to leave it there, but I will suggest your folks, if you want to read more on the subject, it's a very lucid report, A Secure America in a Secure World. And you can find it, I think, on the web. Is that right?
That's correct.
And the address would be www. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Our website is Foreign Policy in Focus, which is www.fpif.org.
Okay, very good. And our guest has been John Gershman, author of that report. Thank you so much, Mr. Gershman.
Thanks a lot, Jack. Have a good day.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine Street in Urbana. This Sunday, September 26th, the Corkscrew will be holding a wine tasting and silent auction at the Cinema Gallery with proceeds for a memorial fund for Pascal Brooks, the son of recently deceased winemaker Jimmy Brooks. More information is available at 337-7704.
That's it for Focus for the morning. Time to hand things off to Jay Pierce, our interim station manager, program director, and afternoon magazine host. Jay?
I emptied a trash can this morning, too.
Oh, janitor, too. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jack. Coming up in the 1 o'clock hour this afternoon of the afternoon.